I have the pleasure today of talking with two gentlemen who are iconic figures in the practice of obstetrics and gynecology in Lancaster. I'm speaking, of course, of John May and Alistair Grant, who have been practicing together in this community since the late 1960s. John, Alistair, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm delighted to have you with us today because I think that your stories and what you have to say about the development of obstetrics and gynecology in the many years since you started practice together really reflect changes in our society as well as in the practice of medicine. Before we go into those things, first let me ask you just a little bit about yourselves and ask you to give me a capsule summary of your training and background before you began practice here. John, let's start with you.
I became interested in being a doctor because of a friend who was actually a dermatologist, but prior to that had been a family doctor in intercourse. And he really cherished his family practice life much more than anything else. And I got inspired by him. And so I always wanted to be a doctor. People, when I was seventh grade, eighth grade, what do you want to do? I always said I want to be a doctor. Probably more in primary care fields like pediatrics, family practice. And it was only during my medical school time that I went through a rotation in obstetrics, and it was such a happy field. I thought, you know, maybe this is for me. I was born and raised in Lancaster, as was my wife. I went to Princeton to college. I went to medical school, University of Pennsylvania. And I interned here at Lancaster General. And I was actually discouraged by the medical school to come to a community hospital because it wasn't academic. And medical schools at that time felt they were judged by where people took their internships because it was a feather in their cap if they went to an academic institution. But I knew I wanted to be in primary care, and so I came here and was very satisfied and had a wonderful experience because there were wonderful educators and clinicians. I also was pretty well assured that I could get an appointment at a good residency through this hospital, as were connections to the Mayo Clinic and Pennsylvania Hospital, which was a very good obstetrical training program. And so I wasn't anxious about getting an appointment for residency coming here. I was in the military, actually got drafted at a residency, and I practiced family practice base in the military. And then came back to town in 1966 as a solo practitioner.
Alistair?
Well, I was born in Prestwick, Ayrshire in Scotland. My father came to Bishop Stortford, which is midway between London and Cambridge, when I was a baby. But I still know that when the Blues play the Whites, which side I'm on, Scotland plays in blue. My decision to become a doctor was very arbitrary and almost instantaneous. When you're about 16, you take what used in those days be called the school certificate, which then farms people into possible university applicants. And the school would divide into two, what was called moderns, French and history, civics, and science. There were three of us who were always batting 1, 2, 3 at the top of the class. And the other two boys had always wanted to be doctors from 9 and 10 years old. I was third in the class at the time, so I didn't have very much time to think. And I wasn't good at chemistry, and I didn't know where French and history took you in this world. And they, of course, had said they wanted to be doctors. And I said, yes, I think I want to be a doctor too. And it was literally as instantaneous as that. I then went up to the London Hospital, now the Royal London Hospital, which is an interesting arrangement. In 1740, three physicians got together in a pub called the Three Fellows in Whitechapel in East London and decided that we need a hospital and a medical school combined. And the London was the first one that was actually a medical school with a hospital attached. I graduated in 1957 and did a number of house jobs, and then caught the tail end of the British draft, which took us to RAF Hospital, Changi in Singapore, for 2.5 years, which, as it turned out, was a sort of dry run for our eventual move to Lancaster, Pennsylvania. My plans were not to stay in a London teaching hospital, although aspiring obstetrician gynecologists take their surgical boards first. But as I say, I was not intending to stay in London. I always thought a county town like Exeter or Bath. I didn't expect it to be 3,500 miles further west in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. But a British anesthesiologist who was here for 6 months at St. Joe's, when asked by Dick Wagner at a dinner one evening, "Do you know anybody in London who might like to come and help John, who is in danger of dying of overwork?" And so Paul wrote to me, and John and I corresponded a time or two, and then I came over to meet him, really with no plans or expectations, and found a glove that fitted, and we just sort of knew that we could make a go of it. One of the interesting things to me was that John, as a 35-year-old, had significant philosophical differences about childbirth from his seniors in practice in town. And we, being of the same age and reading the same papers and coming up the same pathway, saw things very much eye to eye. And I have never regretted joining what became Doctors May Grant.
You intimated that you and John saw things differently from your seniors at the time. The whole world, at least in American society, was changing in many ways at that time. Let me ask you to explore that issue a little bit in terms of how your practice reflected some of the changes in society at the time.
Well, clearly the changes were taking place. It was social upheaval, burning the flag, the rebellion against the Vietnam War, government mismanagement, and right movements developed. Civil rights, they developed and evolved. Women, gay and lesbian issues, and women's rights. We can't take any credit for the development of these rights, but we were the beneficiaries of them because...
But you were responsive to those.
Yes, we were clearly responsive. When a woman who came into the hospital in labor in the late 1960s, she was ushered into a labor and delivery room area, which had a single bed, maybe a double bed, maybe even four people a bed. And the husband was ushered into a waiting room where he stayed until after the delivery process. Nurses would periodically come out to the waiting room and inform the husband what was going on, but they never saw each other. And women took issue with this. And classes began to be developed to allow husbands and wives to share this process, because women and men wanted this sharing, caring, loving process to be part of the laboring process.
Would it be fair to say that you and Alistair encouraged that? In other words, you welcomed that change, and there were practices that did not welcome that change?
Yes, I think that is true. We supported the idea of awake, participating childbirth. The use of pudendal block, for example, rather than the senior obstetricians whose patients were basically anesthetized for the delivery. I remember when I first came into the delivery room to be shown the delivery rooms, there were bracelets on the side of the table to which the patient's hands were restricted. And I remember saying, "You're not going to tie my patients down." Not only the childbirth classes, of husbands coming into the delivery room, of breastfeeding, of rooming in, all these things really came from the patient's request. And we agreed because it fitted with our philosophy.
But that had to stimulate the growth of your practice once the word got out.
Oh, absolutely. There are certain groups. For instance, Franklin Marshall professors' wives, they grabbed at this. And so we quickly collected that group of patients, and the word spread from there. Starting out by myself, seeing nobody for the first year. I mean, it just blossomed.
Was the hospital responsive to this new approach?
Fairness to the hospital. The obstetrical unit was on Lime Street, and they did not have a physical plant to accommodate husbands being with the wife during this process. The hospital, after several years, saw that this was a practice that was developing, and they built a new obstetrical unit on Duke Street on the sixth floor. And they built a unit that had what they call LDR, labor, delivery, and recovery, to allow husband to be present in the labor process and in the delivery process. and then more recently they've moved to women's and babies. So initially the physical setting did not allow for what we wanted to achieve. And consequently, we ended up going more to St. Joseph's Hospital the first 3 or 4 years.
So you're taking this material over to St. Joe's in order to just have the facilities to practice in this manner. When did this hospital, LGH, begin to respond to this changing approach?
Well, it was more than facilities. I think the hospital and the nursing care there was much more responsive and encouraging this process to take place.
At this time, what year are we talking
about? We're talking about 69, 70, 71. When Alistair joined, we probably were delivering more than half of our babies at St. Joseph's Hospital because the general didn't have the physical plan and didn't support the idea.
When did that change take place? I mean, what? Because obviously, as everyone knows now, the vast majority of deliveries in Lancaster County are done in St. Babies, which is a Lancaster General facility.
I think it was with the building of the new obstetric unit, which did, as John said, make it possible for the husband to be present.
And that would have been?
I think that was 1972, 73. I was threatened with dismissal from the General Hospital for taking a husband into the delivery room. And John had a little confrontation over at St. Joe's. At that time, husbands and wives would go down to Wilmington, Delaware to do the childbirth classes. So when he was scrubbing up over at St. Joe's, the husband said, "I'm coming with you." And John had to say, "I'm sorry, it's not allowed." He said, "Either you or I go into the delivery room, but not both." So he gave way and John did the delivery.
Well, to add to that, they called a security officer up to the delivery room to usher this husband, soon to be father, out of the delivery room. The husband was a former football player who played for Penn State, and he said, "Try me."
just what you need at the moment of childbirth is a confrontation.
But the wife would have been awake.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I was supportive with kind of a smirk on my face.
So gradually, obviously, the trend at some point became inescapable, and every institution made it possible to deliver babies in the way that the families and the physicians wanted this to take place. How did this impact other things? And another aspect of care that intrigues me is the fact that outpatient surgery, certainly when I was training, did not exist. Nobody had anything done as an outpatient except maybe having a sebaceous cyst or a lipoma removed. I'm not even sure about lipomas if they were big ones. You obviously were also interested in that aspect of care.
Gynecology lent itself to outpatient surgical unit. D's and C's, tubal division, minor biopsies. So we used the outpatient surgical unit quite vigorously when it started. Saved the patient time and money, and they went home the same day.
A related point is the length of stay for deliveries. I mean, that has obviously contracted tremendously. How long was the stay back when you started?
When I started, a person having their first baby would stay in the hospital 6 days. The multips, as we call them, those having more than one, would stay in 5 days. My in-laws would say they would stay in for 2 weeks. So that gradually went from 6 to 5 down to 4 to 3 until now they stay in 1 or 2 days.
Now, another thing related, it's related to outpatient surgery, is the whole issue of laparoscopy, which, as I understand, is something that you, Alistair, are responsible for bringing, actually, to this community.
We had started doing laparoscopy in London shortly before I came over here, but of course there was no laparoscope, and Dr. John Paul went and bought his own. I sort of more or less showed him how to do it. Then, of course, it burgeoned with the general surgeons taking out the appendix and the gallbladder. And
yeah, but that was more than a decade later.
Oh, yes. Yes, so, this is in the early 70s.
Yeah, so my point being that you all were essentially doing laparoscopy before anyone conceived of it as a surgical tool.
It was a gynecological weapon initially.
Yeah, and you were doing principally procedures related to the fallopian tubes and the ovary.
Diagnostic, tubal division, main ones. Of course, later on with artificial assisted reproduction, then of course they collect the eggs through the scope, but we were not doing that.
One of the biggest advantages I found was the diagnostic area, because a gynecological exam is not precise, and you can do a pelvic exam on a female and think you feel a mass, and you're sure you feel a mass. At that time, there were no x-ray tools. There was no sonography at this point. To look directly into the pelvis and see what was going on avoided a laparotomy. To be put in an awkward position, such as having a family doctor refer you a patient and say, here is a mass, and you've got to remove it. To be able to look directly in and see that there was not a mass avoided a major surgery, and it was a wonderful tool to correspond to the physician and say, you know, it wasn't there.
The next area that I would really like to get into, because it is so directly related to your practice, is the, well, we use the term nowadays physician extenders, but obviously in different specialties that has different connotations. Nurse practitioners, you have midwives. This whole area is one where, once again, the field of OBGYN has really always been on the cutting edge. It's remarkable to me, as we're having this conversation about shorter hospital stays, about awake patients, about outpatient surgery. All of these things are advances that gynecologists have really been the first there in each of those areas, with shortening hospital stays, with awake patients, with outpatient surgery.
So, well, of course, I was brought up in a midwife-orientated obstetric service. In fact, all four of our children were delivered by midwives. One, in fact, was a breech. And in those days, a primate breech was regarded as the intern or doctor's delivery, and a multiple breech was the midwife's delivery. And they were trained to do breech birth. They had an anesthetist present and often a physician, but the actual procedure was conducted by the midwife. And at that time, best part of 80% of patients in Britain were delivered by a midwife.
But you had a procedure, I presume, for training them, certifying them, for laying out the boundaries, and just as you've said, when they would do the delivery, when the physician would do the delivery.
The lovely phrase was used was to summon medical aid. And if a primate was pushing for 2 hours, they had to call the doctor. And a multiple was pushing for an hour, they had to summon medical aid. And all sorts of criteria like that in relation to the delivery of the placenta, of bleeding in the third stage of labor. So there were quite definite prescribed lines. A small percentage of patients were delivered at home by midwives, which didn't usually meet much physician agreement, because it meant frequently the patient got transferred into hospital to a strange circumstance, strange physicians, and away from her midwife. I really pushed very gently, John, saying, should we not employ midwives? And at that time, I suppose in the mid-70s, alternative birthing centres close to a hospital run by midwives became rather voguish, and we elected not to do it, which is just as well, because the ABC, as it was called, has largely disappeared. But of course now the hospital has large groups of midwives, and I can remember in the early days talking to non-obstetric physicians about midwives, and they really regarded them as Sarah Gamps.
Which means?
Sarah Gamp was the old-fashioned nurse, and they really thought it was retrograde to go from physician delivery to midwife delivery.
But does the May Grand practice have midwives employed?
Most all the practices do.
And that, again, is responding to the patient's demands?
I don't think so. I think that's become, I hate to use the word convenience, for the physician. Because certainly in the early days, when we would sit with our patients in labor, and that was a considerable physical demand, both on our time for other things to do within the practice, or in the nights for our sleep. So certainly midwives facilitate a busy practice by taking some of the onus off the physician.
I think it's also part of the expansion of the paramedical individual into the delivery of healthcare, because we, at one point, attempted to get certified nurse practitioners or nurses who are trained in postpartum and obstetrics to come into the hospital and make rounds for us and do some education that we didn't have time to do. And I think you, Dr. Bonchek, were responsible for getting certified practitioners into the hospital when you came and opened the cardiac unit, because we were flatly denied in the late 70s. Now, when your program opened up, then we followed suit and got paramedical people into the hospital, which we already had done in the office. We already had paramedical people teaching classes, teaching patients, and so on. So I think the midwifery issue was part of the involvement of paramedical people in the practice of medicine.
We encountered extreme resistance. I came in 1983 and made it clear that I would not come if the hospital did not approve nurse clinicians, simply because we couldn't run the practice without them, since we didn't have residents. And after considerable discussion, it was eventually approved. And there was resistance from the medical staff as well. But I have to say that within 6 months or so of the medical staff seeing how beneficial the nurse practitioner was in terms of not only enhancing patient care, but enhancing the efficiency of the physician's work, the physician staff all wanted their own nurse practitioners. And of course, nowadays, every practice has multiple physician extenders, as we like to call them. I guess the one last issue that we haven't talked about is the influence of the malpractice environment on the practice of obstetrics, and how does this relate to the whole issue of using midwives? Do they increase, decrease, or not affect your liability?
The question about malpractice and its influence, for example, on the C-section rate, I think is very hard to answer with honesty. Of course, the specter is over one's head, but that's true every time you write notes in the office. You have to think to yourself, what if somebody said this and was looking at this 3 years later? So everything you do is being monitored. But I don't think that when you've got an abnormal fetal heart pattern, you say, I'd better do a C-section in case I get sued. Your attitude more is, you would say to the mother, your baby appears to be in difficulty, and I think we should get him delivered quickly, and you're not going to get a delivery quickly. We ought to do a cesarean section. But I don't think that that is primarily malpractice driven.
I think one of the things that might drive that, and that is this introduction of fetal monitoring, which we are told that certain patterns indicate certain disease processes with a baby. I don't think that we understand those monitoring patterns exactly as we should. So therefore, if we see a pattern that indicates an abnormality in the baby, the question is that pattern truly representing a disease process in the baby or a distress with the baby? I think the obstetrician today will respond to that for the reasons Alistair just said. You want to be able to tell the patient, we want to deliver a healthy baby. This monitor pattern that we have at present indicates there may be some distress. And I think the patient would rather go ahead and have a cesarean section rather than take the chance of having a distressed baby. But do we know how to interpret these patterns exactly? No.
Well, there's so many areas of medicine where we collect information and then we're not sure what to do with it. The MRI and the CAT scan are examples of tests that give us information, but sometimes just lead to more tests. And so I have no doubt that fetal monitoring falls into that category of bringing about some cesarean sections that were unnecessary, in the sense that if you didn't know about it, you would have delivered a healthy baby in the normal way. But when you tell me that C-sections are up to 29%, if I interpret your comment correctly, what you're saying is that that rise is not nearly as often the result of someone being afraid of being sued as it is the result of the patient being presented with information and the patient saying, well, under that circumstance, I would prefer that you do a C-section. Does that fairly represent what you're trying to say?
I think that's true. And there's some other areas where we were trained to deliver babies, and today the young obstetricians are not trained with forceps delivery, deliveries of breech, twins. Here again, you can present statistics to a patient saying this child might be under less risk if we do a cesarean section than if we attempt to deliver with forceps or twins or a breech. And the patient will say, I don't want to take a chance.
This is particularly true in relation to breech birth. Breech delivery was one of the marks of the skilled obstetrician. But you have to say to the patient, your baby is coming as a breech. This carries a 10% greater mortality than coming head first. And although I think we could deliver you vaginally, we can't guarantee it. And therefore, it would be safest to do a cesarean section. The same applies to twins, because the after-coming baby in twins is at a special risk. It's really all, you want the best outcome for the patient. The thing that I did miss when I first came here, we were doing fetal monitoring in London, but also fetal blood sampling. So when you saw an abnormal fetal heart pattern, you then took a sample from a scalp puncture through the vagina. And then you could see whether the baby was already in severe acidosis or not. And if not, you could afford to wait an hour or two and see if she would come to full dilatation. Or you could repeat the sample. So this enabled us to keep the C-section rate down. Whereas today, by using only monitoring, people say this is an alarming pattern and I think we should act. Quite why fetal sampling fell by the wayside, I really don't know.
Well, I suspect it's like many other things. People weren't comfortable doing it or weren't trained to do it.
It wasn't easy.
I should think not. You have access to a small area of the head through the dilated cervix.
5 centimeters.
Now, what is the manpower situation nowadays in obstetrics with all of the malpractice concern that we hear about and the high rates? Are people going into the specialty?
The college is actively recruiting and goes to medical schools to show students the attractions of obstetrics and gynecology. So obviously, they feel that the recruitment is not as high as one would wish.
The criterion for monitoring the shortage is whether or not residencies are going unfilled. Do you know anything about that?
They are filling. There was a dip 10 years ago, but that has reversed.
Now, that's also partly due to the influx of women into the field, I presume. What percentage of obstetricians now are women?
College is over 50% female.
And medical schools are over 50% female.
That's true.
But I think women are attracted to, and vice versa, patients are attracted to women. I think there's probably more going to OBGYN relative to other specialties. That's purely a guess.
Well, the fact is that there's going to be an extreme shortage of physicians right across the board in every specialty, and it's a serious problem. It's one that the hospital here is very well aware of, and in fact, I'm chairing this commission that's looking into the whole question of manpower, medical education, and how to plan for our needs going forward over the next few decades, not just the next few years. So I think OBGYN is one of many such cases. Now, while we're on the subject of medical manpower, let me focus in on your specialty, obstetrics, and let me ask you, what has happened to the birth rate in Lancaster County?
In reference to you studying demands for obstetrics, it's interesting the number of deliveries in Lancaster County is no higher today than it was in 1970. There are about 6,000 hospital deliveries in the county today at Women's and Babies and Everett Hospital and Heart of Lancaster. 1970, the Columbia delivered and Efferta delivered and Lancaster Osteopathy delivered. But the number of deliveries are about the same. Even though the population of Lancaster is going around 300,000 in 1970 to close to 500,000 now, that growth is in the geriatric population. People are living longer, and the growth rate in that age group is increasing by 20% a year. And introduction of retirement communities in Lancaster also adds to the growth in the older age group. But actually, the growth in the 15 to 44 women group is not really changing that much.
I think also a factor here is smaller families, reliable contraception, vasectomy, tubal division. People are controlling the number of children they have, thinking of college fees and so on down the pike. So the birth rate, in fact, in the county has not increased.
Well, I think we've covered a tremendous number of very interesting subjects, and I want to thank both of you, not only for coming here today, but for what you've done to transform the practice of OBGYN here in Lancaster. Thank you very much.